I'd like to remind all participants this conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. You may begin.
Thank you, Kelly. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everyone. Welcome to the IRTPD Working Group call on Monday, 19th of August, 2013. On the call today, we have James Bladle, Chris Chaplow, Paul Diaz, Avery Doria, Kristen Durain, Angie Graves, Volker Grayman, Barbara Knight, Bob Mountain, Mikey O'Connor, Bartlett Morgan, and Graham Bunton. We have no apologies so far. And from staff, we have Lars Hoffman and myself, Shridesh Avalin. May I please remind all participants to please state their names before speaking for transcript purposes. Thank you very much, and over to you.
Okay, thank you, and welcome everyone to the IRTPD Working Group call for Monday, August 19th, as per our usual rules of operation. Could anyone please indicate by raising their hand or getting my attention on the phone if they have any updates to their statements of interest? Okay, seeing none, then I would please direct your attention to the proposed agenda that is posted in the right-hand column of the Adobe room as well as circulated to the mailing list earlier. Anyone have any comments or suggestions relative to that? Okay, thank you. All right, well, welcome everybody, and we are, when we last left our heroes, we were just starting to do a deep dive into charter question B, which currently reads whether additional provisions should be included in the TDRP on how to handle disputes when multiple transfers have occurred. And if memory serves, we were kind of arriving at this place where we were essentially saying that the TDRP involvement would be limited to the first registrar and the last registrar in any kind of a chain of register hopping, and that the registrars in the intermediary probably had a lesser role in any kind of a dispute process, if any. So, you know, I think that's where we kind of left off the conversation last week. Lars, can you perhaps, I don't mean to put you on the spot here, but can you help us refresh where we were going with this and what remains for us to discuss on this particular issue?
Hey, James, it's Lars. I'm just going through the notes. I think you're right. The discussion was the key would be that the first register would have to provide all the information that led to the first transfer. I'm just scrolling up to the charter question. And then the question still, I think, that remains open is how would if the first jump was illegal and there were legal jumps in between, right? Where would you go back to? And there was an argument being made that about the different issues of if you buy a stolen car from somebody, it still would go back to the legitimately, if you want, it would still go back to the original owner. And so would that be the same principle that would apply in this case? I think that's one of the points that still need to be clarified. Who would have the final ownership of the domain if legitimate changes would take place?
Right, and I think that's where we were kind of getting into a little bit of the stickiness surrounding this issue is that if that some of the intermediary hops or intermediary registrars may have, from their perspective, conducted legitimate transfers, but if the initial transfer was not legitimate, it was inherited throughout the whole chain of transfers. And I guess the question then becomes, and per our charter question, is does the current TDRP language provide sufficient mechanisms to undo when a chain of transfers is involved? Or does this practice, this register hopping, laundering, whatever we want to call it, does this practice actually thwart the TDRP and prevent it from being useful? If the answer is that that the TDRP kind of in its current state is adequately dealing with this issue and ignores these other chains, then maybe the answer to charter question B is no, we don't need additional provisions. But if we can see that there are shortcomings in the TDRP, that this or some vulnerabilities that are exposed by this practice, then I think the answer would be yes, we need to come up with some ideas to close these loopholes. So I guess that's the question on the table. I don't know if it helps to review some of the comments and feedback that we've captured here on the screen in the public review or the feedback review tool, because I think that's more of an acknowledgement that registrar hopping is a problem. But I guess what we're trying to quantify is it a fixable problem or is it an unfixable problem? And does the TDRP need to be modified for it? So, Christine, you're up.
Hi, yeah, this is Christine from NAF. I was just asked, maybe I missed because I missed a couple of meetings in there. I know you haven't actually talked necessarily about amending the TDRP yet, but if you did, I noticed that there's a 6-month statute of limitations in the TDRP. Would we be talking about like reducing that statute of limitations, or would we be talking about some other fix to the TDRP, or perhaps I'm just jumping the gun?
Thanks, Christine. I think all options are on the table, but before we kind of grab our toolkit and start working around under the hood, I think we first need to understand, is this, is the current iteration of the TDRP vulnerable or susceptible to this practice? That's the question I'm putting out there first, is do we have examples where someone would like to dispute a transfer and it would have been successful, however, since it changed hands so many times, the TDRP is useless. Is that the case?
So from the provider's perspective, I would say that we have not heard of anything like that. Now, as we know, we've had 6 cases ever. We have had a fair number of inquiries from individuals who wish to participate in the TDRP process. Neither from individuals nor from registrars have we heard the complaint that, gosh, I would have liked to participate in this process, but it's already transferred away to a different registrar. I have never heard of that anecdotally, but we have obviously there's no way to, actually track that sort of inquiry or that sort of comment.
Okay. Maybe we can turn it around. Thank you, Christine. I think that was helpful. But maybe we can turn it around. Do we have an instance or, anecdotally or otherwise, where a TDRP was successfully concluded even though multiple transfers had occurred? Anybody aware of
that? Not with me. Not with the National Arbitration Forum, no.
Okay. Oh, I see Barbara has her hand up to rescue me. Hi, Barbara.
Hi, James. Thank you. This is Barbara. Yeah, unfortunately, I don't have a specific instance. I can go back through and look at the various cases that we've decided. I know that we've had some presented to us where a third registrar, if you will, was involved. So there was dispute between the first and the second saying that there was a violation of the policy, and yet the name was actually currently managed by a third. I can go in and see if I can pull cases relating to those, but I don't know off the top of my head if we've actually made a decision for, requiring it to be unrolled and returned back to the first one.
Okay, thanks, Barbara. I think another question that might factor into this discussion is that the recent conclusion of a PDP on locking the UDRP, where I think that we, I think as a community, acknowledged that this was also a problem in terms of flight from a UDRP, where someone would try to escape a UDRP by transferring multiple times, and then therefore this idea of locking the domain name against transfers occurred. So that's one thing. I mean, perhaps that would be a sufficient solution for TDRP if indeed we're able to identify that there is a problem. I think everyone involved would probably just look at this and acknowledge that it is a problem. I mean, yeah, it's really terrible if you are involved in what you think is a legitimate transaction and then somebody points out that 4 months prior that something illegitimate happened and Everybody in between is now, you know, lost a domain name and possibly lost money as well. And I think that is, you know, we can't necessarily dismiss the harms associated with this. But I think that the charter question itself is very specific about what impact this has on the TDRP in its current form and whether it needs to be modified for that. So I think maybe the charter question, you know, is too limiting. That's one possibility. But I guess I'm starting to come down on the idea that we may perhaps need a little bit more data on this. Any thoughts from the group on this, Mikey?
Thanks, James. It's Mikey. I think that another way to approach this is sort of the problem with data in this is that our data set is so small.
Right.
You know, I think that, you know, Christine raises a really interesting point, which is when you only have a data set of six, it's pretty tough to draw much in terms of conclusions from that, and that we might instead want to come at this from more of a theoretical standpoint and say, you know, look, this isn't invoked very often, but when it's invoked, is it appropriate to have a six-month statute of limitations? Because it's pretty likely that this is sort of the last resort for, you know, either a registrant or a registrar to get this kind of problem fixed. And it could very likely be more than 6 months away. And, you know, by having that clear demarcation out there, we sort of present the target for the bad actor to incubate the domain for 6 months and a day and then wake it up and move it away. And that seems like a fairly easy problem to fix by just removing the statute of limitations. I mean, I understand how upsetting it would be if you find that you've purchased a stolen domain name, but I think going any way but the way normal civil law goes and essentially allowing people to erase an illegitimate transfer by making a couple of legitimate ones, I think that's a bad idea. So those are my two thoughts.
But thanks, Mikey. I think there's some good points in there. I think the first one being that since we don't have much in the way of a sample size, we should probably maybe walk through a hypothetical on this one and see where the TDRP fails. I think that's going to require us to be a little creative and do some tabletop simulations of what that might look like. To your other point, I think you know, it is kind of an acknowledgement of a problem that exists. I think we could consider the idea that we would just remove the 6 months time period here. I think that some of the folks from the aftermarket community would then respond with, well, when do I know that any domain name registration that's older than, that wasn't a new registration, you know, is safe? And I think that probably kicks it back over to industry to come up with some sort of a title search service or something equivalent to that. And then to your third point here, I think that covered it, but maybe I forgot your third point. Christine is now up. Christine, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. This is Christine from Nathigan. I just was, my thought really wasn't just removing the six-month statute of limitations, but actually from the provider's standpoint, I think my recommendation, or at least throwing out there for a group discussion, would be to tighten it. I think that, you know, as with most things, the faster you can get the TDRP filed, the less likely there is to have a multiple series of transfers in the middle. And then throwing this out there, I guess, to registrants or registrars, how likely is it that someone would realize that their domain name was, you know, mistransferred, before 6 months. I guess from my perspective, it seems like that would be something that you would possibly notice pretty quickly. But maybe I'm wrong, and you know, any domain of value, I would think you would notice. But I just thought I'd throw that out there. Like, I'm almost wondering if you would shorten the statute of limitations to 30 or 60 days, open it up to parties, you know, registrants, and then that way you open it up to more people who can file, but then there's a shorter period in which you can file. And then you maybe, you know, preempt a lot of transfers. If, you know, isn't there a 60-day, once you transfer a domain name, you can't transfer it out again for 60 days anyway? So perhaps there's something there. Again, I'm speaking in all of my ignorance on that issue.
Okay, thanks, Christine. I think that, to Mikey's point, there's always going to be that arbitrary cutoff, whether it's 30 days or 60 days or 5 years, there's always going to be that boundary where someone will just age a stolen domain, but, well, maybe 5 years is a little bit much. I think that part of what you're, if I'm understanding your proposal correctly, part of what you're putting on the table is the idea that the time frame would be shortened, but it would be predicated on the idea that registrants would be able to initiate this process directly and not necessarily have to go through a registrar, and that might speed things up. Mikey, you're up?
Yes, that's what I was suggesting.
Okay, thanks for the clarification. And I'm going to put myself in the back of the queue. Mikey, you're up.
Thanks, James. It's Mikey. I think the problem here is that a clever thief can make it, can steal the domain in a way that many registrants wouldn't notice it until after any arbitrary amount of time. And, you know, this is a puzzler, but it's relatively easy for the bad guys to do that. And so if we made it really short, I think that would put a giant fence post up there for bad guys to shoot at, and they'd just wait 30 days, having already captured the name. You know, they would leave all the information at the registrar the same, but they would have captured the credentials and move the domain in such a way that the registrant, a vigilant registrant would see it, but a typical registrant very often would not. That's the puzzle.
Thanks, Mikey, and in fact, we have seen that kind of behavior as well, where someone would hijack the name and then essentially, I call it hijacking in place, where there would be no transfers involved at all. They would just, compromise the account, sell the name, and then, the seller is wondering why the transfer would never occur, or like you said, or the registrant wouldn't notice until it was too late. So I think that's another good point. Volker, you're up next.
Yeah, I kind of agree with Mikey here. This is somewhat of a puzzler. I mean, for us as a registrar, it's pretty much impossible to see if an actual owner change has taken place or if it's just the credentials being exchanged for another pair of credentials that belong to the same entity, if it's a hijack, the hijacker, or someone working in collusion with the hijacker, or if it's a legitimate third party who in good faith purchased the domain name from another third party who purchased the domain name that might have been hijacked somewhere down the road. I'm not happy with any cutoff date. I'm not happy with having no cutoff date. I think this is something that should be handled by the courts, actually, and not by an arbitration panel, once multiple hops have taken place. Handling this in arbitration just opens up all kinds of liabilities for all kinds of parties, and I'm not sure if that's the best way to go with this problem.
Thank you, Volker. I think that's. I think you've added some excellent points here, which are that if we start to expand TDRP to anything beyond just the dispute of a particular transaction or transfer function, that it does start to look like we are designing a system to adjudicate commercial disputes, and then that could create some other risks and liabilities and things like that. Am I capturing that correctly, Volker? Or?
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much.
Okay. You can go ahead. I'll put myself behind you in the queue. Go ahead if you'd like to weigh in on something else or expand on that.
Yeah, I wanted to raise another point just in support of what Christine said. I mean, we've seen a couple of cases where, and of what Mikey said, of course, as well, we've seen a couple of cases where the hijacker is very slow in changing any data at all. We've seen cases where the domain is pushed from one account to the other account, left there for half a year, name service not changed, ownership data not changed, then the email address is changed, which is taken care of by IOTPC now as a problem, I think. Then the domain is transferred to another registrar, and even then the ownership change, the use of the domain name only changes after a long time, so it's very hard to for the registrar to show that the domain name has not been transferred by him or with his acceptance, because the data used for the domain name remains the same so long after the registration data changed. And it's really, I agree with Mikey again. I must, he put it very succinctly by calling it a puzzler. It is. It's very difficult for us as registrars to adjudicate and to find any solution for that kind of changes, even before this goes to a dispute resolution provider. And even then, I don't think that these are very clear-cut cases of what usually is adjudicated by dispute providers.
Thank you, Volker. Mikey, I saw your hand go up and then go down. Did you want to weigh in on this as well? Or?
This is Mikey. I'm chewing on Volker's idea of getting rid of the PERP. And I just wanted to acknowledge that that's probably something we ought to think about. I'm not sure I've got a reaction right away. My sort of knee-jerk reactions were that having an ICANN-sponsored and managed process, you know, although it's complicated and hard, it might do a better job of adjudicating these very esoteric disputes than trying to take them to a general court of law where I can imagine a court not really having the expertise or the understanding to be able to actually do a very good job of adjudicating. And so it sort of falls into the, no, it's not terribly satisfactory, but it's better than any of the other alternatives column for me right now. But I just mostly threw my hand up because it did fire a whole lot of thinking, and I think it's a worthy thing to think about some more.
Okay, thanks, Mikey. And I think to your point there, a lot of the same justifications for why ICANN has a UVRP could be applied here, which is we're attempting to develop a process, as Christine points out, that neutralizes some of these jurisdictional issues and solves the majority of these problems before they go out into the court system. So I think that, you know, that would be one possible response, would be that if we look at the reasoning behind development of a UDRP, you know, and then maybe that some of the can be borrowed for the existence, to justify the existence of a TDRP. I wanted to throw one other thing out here, and I wanted to put my registrar hat on for a couple minutes and just kind of weigh in on this issue. I'm not sure that registrar hopping thwarts or undermines the TVRP. Maybe it does, but I know that we don't have any examples of that, and I know that doesn't prove anything, but maybe I want to make sure that we're not chasing a ghost here. It definitely complicates registrar-to-registrar efforts to untangle a hijacking that has multiple hops. And it definitely complicates those issues where those communication channels where two or more registrars are trying to figure out what happened and return a domain name to the rightful registrant. So no question that it messes up that process. But does it mess up a TDRP, particularly when a TDRP enforcement would just look at the first registrar, look at the last registrar, and then doesn't have to reverse all of those transfers. It just essentially goes from the first registrar or the last registrar in the chain to the first registrar in a single transaction. I mean, that's one thought. And then the second thought would be just winding back to our charter question here, which is, I think, in some ways, is a little more narrow than our discussions have been today, which is, do we need additional provisions? Which seems to imply that there already are provisions in the TDRP to address this, or that it's already capable of handling this problem. I don't know if that's the case. I just want to maybe put that out on the table as something that we should look at before we charge off and add additional provisions. Can we demonstrate that the existing policy would fail in a hypothetical hopping case? So I'll go to Mikey first, and then Volker and Barbara. Mikey?
This is Mikey. Since I was on the drafting team that wrote that question long ago.
Oh, yeah, definitely weigh in on that. I wasn't aware of that.
I wouldn't pay a whole lot of attention to the additional. A sense of this charter question is really in the multiple transfers emphasis, not on additional choice. What we were really working on was the registrar hopping problem, and if it turns out that subtracting provisions would solve the problem, I don't think the drafters of this charter question would object to that. So that's the only thing. I pay little attention, if any, to additional.
Thanks. So we've got some leeway there. That's good. Volker.
Sorry, I had myself on mute. I'm not trying to say that we should get rid of the TDRP, as I think my comments might have been understood earlier. I'm just thinking, trying to figure out what is the best way to where the TDRP applies, and what are the cases where it might not apply or might be less suitable to handle the problem at hand. I think for conflicts between registrars where one registrar may have not operated quite under the requirements, I think the TDRP of a transfer process, the TDRP is very well suited for a third party to adjudicate if the proper procedures have been followed, and then undoing a transfer if those procedures have not been followed. However, what we are now discussing is cases where the procedure between the registrars of initiating and executing a transfer have been followed to the letter, and it's actually a problem on the registrant's side of keeping his account details confidential, or his account security in place, or the registrar being insecure and allowing intrusions. So these kinds of questions actually, in my opinion, require forensic investigation of the transfer in the customer account, and I'm not sure if a third-party provider can actually even handle that. For us, we only store IP addresses for as long as we need them to execute the the transactions. So when we have a transfer, it's very hard for us to see after a while if the transfer request originated from the IP address where we usually would get this customer's requests from, which would be nice to have, but we don't store the IPs for that long, we cannot compare those. And at that stage, it becomes very, very hard for a third party, even when it's very hard for us as a registrar, for a third party to adjudicate if the transfer was legitimate or not. So I think the TDIP is very well suited for addressing formalisms, have the formal requirements of the transfer policy been followed, and not as much suitable for handling authorization issues.
Okay, thank you, Volker. Barbara, your thoughts?
Thank you, James. This is Barbara. So I just wanted to say that under the TDRP, dispute resolution providers are able to also put in place supplemental rules. And within those rules, I suppose it could be addressed, you know, kind of what the process is for handling situations where you have a third registrar involved that may not have been, you know, party to the dispute between the registrars, or the transfer between the registrars that are, I guess, subject to the dispute case proceeding. So, I mean, that may be a place to address it, you know, short of having to do a complete revision to the policy itself.
So, Barbara, can we put you on the spot here a little bit, and perhaps Christine as well, to expand on that thought for just a moment? So, rather than adjusting the language of the TDRP, we would essentially shift some of these supplemental rules into and hard code those into the language of the policy. And I guess I'm curious as to whether that would be something of a standardization effort where we would figure out which of the providers, whether it's a registry or whether it's a second level provider, figure out which particular rules or procedures we would want to adopt, and then we would write up those. Am I understanding that correctly?
I mean, I suppose that you could. I mean, that wasn't what I was intending. I mean, in our supplemental rules, we do have a section that's in the miscellaneous area of our supplemental rules, which speaks to invalid transfers disregarded as the topic, and it basically just says that transfers from a gaining registrar party to a third-party registrar and all other subsequent transfers are null and void if the gaining registrar acquired sponsorship from the registrar of record through an invalid transfer as determined through the dispute resolution process set forth in the dispute policy. In such case, VeriSign will implement a decision in accordance with the dispute policy as if the subsequent transfers had not occurred. So that's how we've dealt with it at VeriSign.
Okay. And so just clarifying on that VeriSign bit, it doesn't matter how many subsequent transfers occurred, you're only reviewing and making a decision on that first claimed invalid transfer.
That's correct.
And then just following through on that a little bit, if VeriSign determines that transfer was in fact invalid and wants to reverse it, it then issues a decision to the current registrar of record?
We would notify them, yes. In fact, you know, if a case is filed, a request for enforcement is filed with us, we will give the current registrar of record a heads up that we've received it and that we are currently, you know, reviewing it, you know, on its merit. And then to the extent, and I've actually asked one of the folks on my team to see if, you know, we've actually had any cases where we have done a reversal, in that particular case where we've had to take it from a registrar that wasn't party to the dispute and put it back to the original registrar, but I don't have that data as yet. It may take us a little bit of time because we've got to ask for some information from our DBAs in order to be able to look at that further. But yes, we would basically take it from the third registrar back to the first one. That we would provide the registrar of record that's currently managing the domain name with an advice that we would be taking that action.
Okay, and then in that particular case, and I'm sorry to, I know I've got a queue here, but in that particular case, you wouldn't require any documentation or evidence from that third registrar on their transfer. This is really just a courtesy notification to them that the previous transfer is under review, and then notifying them if you implement that.
Sorry, yes, that is how we've implemented it.
Okay.
Because, I mean, it could very well be, and more than likely, the transfer from whichever registrar, depending on, you know, the registrar immediately prior to them, whether it be the second or the fifth, it doesn't matter, really. I can't imagine it would be the fifth, given the, you know, the restriction on transfers after a transfer has occurred and the statute of limitations for filing. But regardless of the number, I mean, it could very well be that the transfer to whoever is managing the name at the time that the transfer dispute was filed, it may very well have been a legitimate transfer in accordance with the policy. But, you know, it kind of goes back to the whole, I really liked the, I guess, the analogy with the stolen car. You know, unfortunately, it does happen occasionally, but that doesn't mean that the person who the car was originally stolen from doesn't have rights to that car. I mean, they still technically own the car.
Right. Okay, that's interesting, because it's good information, and we would certainly appreciate anything that you find when you follow up on that internally. But I think it also starts to kind of shed a little bit of light that that the current process, at least when you combine the policy and the supplemental rules of the provider, is able to deal with this, at least to some extent, maybe not in all cases. I'll go with Mikey and then Christine. Mikey?
Thanks, James. This is Mikey. Just another question for Barbara. When you rummage through the data, which sounds like a great place to start, one of the interesting questions to ask of that would be the impact of the six-month statute of living, statute of limitation, sorry. In other words, how many times, you know, I'm contradicting myself, of course, but foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of small minds. But it seems to me it would be useful to know how many times these things have gone off the rails because they were outside that six-month window. So that was my thought. It seems to me that we do have, and you mentioned it, but I want to highlight that point, Barbara, that with the new IRTPC rules about change of registrant delays, 60 days, essentially we make it impossible for the hops beyond three to be handled by the TDRP as it stands right now, because three hops at 60 days each would put us out to 6 months. And again, the question is that a good idea?
Okay, thanks, Mikey. Let's move to Christine next.
Thanks. This is Christine from NAF. I just wanted to comment that I think that I agree with Barbara that it's possible that the supplemental rules of the providers could be engaged to address the multiple hops issue if we decide that that's a way, you know, one way to solve the problem. I just wanted to point out that it's going to be really hard for the group to mandate supplemental rules. I know that the providers do not, I mean, we sort of clear our supplemental rules through ICANN, in which we send them to ICANN's legal, and if there's no objection, we sort of carry on with them. So ICANN doesn't mandate how our supplemental rules work. So I'm willing, you know, and I've in all the working groups, I've been willing to, you know, amend my supplemental rules as need be for practicality and to make things happen. But just to be really clear that the supplemental rules aren't consensus policy, and so to mandate that down to the other TDRP provider or maybe even to other registries, I think would be really hard from the working group perspective. So while I think it's a good solution to think about, you can't force it. It has to be sort of a, here's a good suggestion. If you're smart, you'll take it. So I just wanted to throw that out there before we go too far down to put it in the supplemental rules category.
Thanks, Christine, and good point here. And before we go to Barbara, just a couple of quick questions. So if we wanted to standardize a particular practice, I think, if I'm understanding you, it should go into the language of the policy, and that would ensure that we don't leave it up to the individual providers to perhaps put their own spin on it in their supplemental rules or disregard it entirely. I mean, that's another possibility, right? So if I'm understanding you correctly,
absolutely.
If we wanted to see uniform behavior or treatment of these types of cases, it would have to go into the policy and not the supplemental rules.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification. That's good to know, and I think it you know, as a registrar, it certainly makes sense. We have a number of internal procedures that are not, let's say, not subject to ICANN policy. That if we want to do something that ensures that all registrars treat situations uniformly, then that's where we put those things. Barbara, go ahead. You're up next.
This is Barbara. So, yes, Christine, you do have actually very good points relative to that, and I agree that, you know, anything that would have to be a requirement for everybody to comply with would have to be made part of the consensus policy because, you know, you are correct in stating that supplemental rules definitely are not, they're not consensus policy. I did want to just add, the reason I raised my hand as well was just to address or actually let Mikey know that relative to those he was asking when we were looking at the data, how many fall outside of the six-month statute? Unfortunately, we really don't have any visibility into that because we would only be able to see what is actually filed with us as a case. And typically, to my recollection, I don't recall seeing any that would really come in that have been outside of the filing window. So we wouldn't have really visibility to be able to say, you know, multiple jumps that, you know, extended beyond the six-month window. Does that make sense?
It does. Thanks. It's almost like asking how many of these weren't filed.
Yeah. We have no idea.
I get that. Yeah, that's a bit of a logic problem. Mikey, go ahead.
Yeah, I get that. And as you were talking, Barbara, one of the things that occurred to me is that the way that the new IRTPC rules work interact with the TDRP, and one thing about this is to sort of say, well, how many hops do we want to try and protect against? And right now we're at three. Basically, if the hops happen as fast as they can go. And is that enough given the sweeping domain problem? So, you know, the more I think about it, the more I think, you know, in gambling strategies in casinos, there are all these strategies that work great as long as there's no house limit. But as soon as you put a house limit, a maximum size of the bet, the strategy breaks down. And in a way, what the six-month rule does is the same sort of thing. It breaks what we're trying to do in the IRTP by putting a limit. And the more I think about it, the better I like the idea of taking that limit out.
Thanks, Mikey, and I'm actually I put myself in the queue because I wanted to ask a question. I'm actually fairly intrigued by that last bit about the cutoff point being a house limit. I'm wondering if that sounds like there might be some math involved. I'm wondering if you would be willing to maybe expand on that on the list. I'm not sure if we have sufficient time on the call. But I think that given that that starts to lend towards a position of there should be no statute of limitations where a stolen domain name is, you know, I'm using air quotes over here, is in the clear and outside the arm of any kind of dispute, then I think that, you know, that would be a pretty extraordinary change to the policy. I'm not saying it's unwarranted, but it would be a fairly extraordinary change, and I think we would need to have sufficiently extraordinary justification for a recommendation like that. So I think building on your point about the you know, how that would impact just overall the idea of the strategy of that being a limitation, I think that would, you know, we probably should expand on that further. I was going to mention something and I lost my point, so I'm going to go ahead and go to Volker and Barbara and put myself at the back of the queue. Volker?
Yeah, I'm a bit on the fence about this limitation. On the one hand, I agree that having a limitation just opens up the policy for gaming, because any hijacker that wanted to make his hijack secure would just refrain from making any changes, pointing out that there a change of control has actually happened, and then after the deadline has happened, then would do everything to gain actual control of the domain name. On the other hand, removing the deadline entirely would mean that I, as a domain owner or a purchaser of a domain name, would never be certain if a few hops ago the domain name had not been hijacked and somebody would be able to bring a complaint against that first transfer and take away my domain name. So I think it would have to be the solution that we come up with would have to be very, very measured, and that is leads back to my initial comment that I would prefer these issues to be handled in the courts instead of an arbitration arbitration decision.
Okay, thank you, Volker. I tend to agree that you know, removing that would perhaps address some problems, but perhaps create more if we remove the 6 months. I think one thought on that, and I'm not necessarily trying to sway the group in one direction or another, but just a thought to consider, is that we are still sort of in the dawn of this industry, let's say. We are, you know, maybe closer to the beginning, you know, than, you know, if we look at its useful lifespan. So we may be only dealing with domain names that were registered, you know, 8-10 years ago. Of course, Mikey has a pocket full of names that were registered back when I was in college. But I think that's the exception. I think the you know, the bulk of the bell curve there was probably in the, you know, in the earlier last 8-10 years. But what happens when these domain names are 25, 30 years old and that they're still being transacted and disputes could weigh in that are taking it all the way back to 2004? I think that's an extreme, perhaps hypothetical, but it's something that should maybe be a factor in our decision, or at least part of our deliberation, as this industry continues to grow up and mature. So, Barbara, you're up next.
Thank you, James. This is Barbara. You know, I think that Volker actually makes some really good points about, you know, maybe that these types of disputes would be better handled in the courts versus in, you know, the dispute and arbitration type of environment. But one of the things that I wanted to suggest is I'm not really in favor of not having any cutoff point for filing a dispute under the TDRP. I mean, maybe what we do is we do something along the lines of, you know, 6 months, you know, the latter of 6 months, or when the domain name comes up for renewal of the, you know, term during which time the alleged violation occurred. Because at the time that it comes up for renewal, the registrant of the domain name should have an idea that, wait a minute, you know, I've not renewed my name, but somebody else must have done it. You know, they would have some clue as to, you know, there was some sort of an issue that has occurred with their name at that point, I would think. Like I said, I personally, I don't know that 6 months is the right time period for filing the dispute, but I do think there should be some end point after which time, because, you know, James, you're making a good point about, you know, some of these domain names could very well, you know, be 30 years old at some point, and do you want to really go back to, you know, a domain name that was transferred 20 years ago or what have you? Just my two cents.
Thanks, Barbara. I think that's a good point, and I like the idea of having a later of you know, certain period or, you know, this renewal or expiration or redemption or some other event-driven time cutoff. I'm going to give Mikey the last word, but I remembered what I was going to weigh in on earlier, and unfortunately I think it adds a whole new layer of complexity. So maybe we don't want to get into it on this call, but it is something to think about, is that we did refer to the other type of policy, the change of registrant transfer that was developed as a component of IRTPC. And the question that I think that maybe we're assuming or maybe we didn't examine very completely is whether or not TDRP would also allow the dispute of those types of transfers, which are slightly different than a transfer that is an inter-registrar transfer. And certainly that process, the change of registrant process, did not exist when our charter was developed. So is this a gap? Is this something that we missed? And do we need to account for that? Maybe I'll ask Lars to bookmark that idea for discussion next time. But we're 6 minutes left in our call, and I want to give Mikey the last word and have him take us home. Mikey.
Thanks, James. That was a really good idea. I was sort of going, oh. So I completely agree on your last point about the impact of change of registrant on this. We certainly need to fold that in. A couple of points to Volker's thing. I think one of the facets of the justification of this is that, look, the TDRP is a really infrequent process. We can definitely demonstrate that. It's very structured. It's really rigorous. It's very specialized. And so I don't imagine that we're going to see very many instances of this ever being invoked, but if it ever is, it would be, I think, really helpful to be able to go longer than an arbitrary amount, because this is sort of, in a way, planning for the crime of the century. This is an extremely valuable name being taken by very sophisticated folks, and this is precisely the place where a typical court isn't going to have a clue about what's going on, because it's going to be a very tightly argued, very technical case. So I think there's an argument to be made that the TDRP is a better place to resolve some of these things than the courts. In terms of Barbara's point, the typical registrant today probably won't even have a clue at renewal time, because typically they put auto-renew on and they then forget about that domain, and it just automatically continues to be there. So I'm not sure that the renewal boundary is good from that standpoint, and I'd also just note that the renewal interval these days is often 5 years, which is pretty long. I mean, if we went all the way out to renewal on a relatively new name, that's much longer than 6 months. So I think there's some puzzlers in that as well. So just a few thoughts, but James, I do think that you've got a good one there with that. And with that, I'm all done. Back to you.
Okay, Mikey, thanks. And I think, some thoughts about the renewal thing is something for us to chew on, particularly in light of, and just because it's fresh on my brain right now, is the implementation of the ERRP, which even if the name is auto-renew, registrars are almost required to spam registrants with notifications of their impending expiry and auto-renew. So it's... in some respects, it will still auto-renew, as you pointed out, but it will be less of an automatic or invisible process to registrants because of this new policy that we're implementing on August 31st. But anyway, let's go to, we've got just real quick couple of minutes left here. We'll go to Herr Greiman here, and then I'll close us off for the day. Volker?
Yeah, thank you, Herr Bladel. I was just thinking that I agree that this is a very rare process.
Volker, the sound quality, at least for me, is almost unusable. Can you?
Better?
Ah, much.
Better
thank
now?
You.
I had to just speak into the microphone again. I agree. This is currently a very rare process, but we were also discussing if maybe we wanted to open this up for registrants to use instead of being a process involved between registrars. And at that point, I don't think that we can rely on this being a rare process anymore, because registrants that want to contest a transfer will use it in any case. So if we change the access requirements to this process, we cannot rely on previous experience on the rarity of these kinds of cases. That's just the point I wanted to make.
Thank you, Volker, and it's a good point, and it also made me think just a moment here. When we say we open up this to registrants, we really actually mean opening up to the general public, don't we? Because we're talking about former registrants disputing the current registrant. So it wouldn't necessarily be a registrant. It's more of an ex-registrant. But that's just a nitpicking here, but it is something that maybe we should think about. So lots of good thoughts today. Thank you, everyone, for participating and contributing your ideas and your expertise and your experience. And we will look for everyone to reconvene this group same time next week on the 26th of August, where we will be led by Mr. Mikey O'Connor.
Mikey.
Who will take the lead because I will be pulled into another ICANN function and will be on the other side of the world. So thank you very much, everyone. Have a great Monday, and look for traffic on the list.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, James.